Chili Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now, the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Chelly.
Second day of May 2022, allegedly according to that thing we call a calendar, and therefore, guess what that means? You're listening to my show. How do I know this? Because you're hearing me say what I'm saying. Anyway, Moonday, the first broadcast day of the week for the O'Chelly Effect, and we are continuing the discussions with JFK-related authors that I have not had on the show previously. Now, this is going to be an interesting one because this is one of the really understudied areas in my mind, which gives us the framework for what I believe is the motive connected to the assassination. And many a person will argue with me, and perhaps there'll be some arguments tonight. I have a professor with me, an interesting gentleman who has written a book called JFK versus Alan Dulles, Battleground Indonesia. Now, you may have noted before that I've stressed that JFK's foreign policy is extremely important when understanding why someone might be motivated to see him not remain in the presidency. I don't know, maybe I've just been saying that for about a decade on radio shows and things like this, but I've been saying it for, I don't know, let's see, let's go back. Well, a good 2.5 decades everywhere. But anyway, that's not important, and what I have to say is not important tonight. The author's statements are going to be the important thing, and we're going to get into this. But I also have a special surprise. We have Bob Wilson, the host of I'm Looking Through You, which airs Sundays, coincidentally, on this little radio network that we're on right now. And I produce that show. Bob Wilson is with me. He's going to assist me with this interview because I need assistance. There's a lot of information here. There is a lot, and obviously we're not going to get to all of it. I mean, we can't condense a book into one radio show, but this is going to be worth your time, and it's going to be some fresh material, but there may also be some very familiar things that you're going to hear during this discussion. Anyway, enough out of me. First of all, Bob, I'm going to put you on hold for a second here because I want to ask, we straighten this out. Polgrain is the way to pronounce his last name, but I'm just going to call him Greg here. How are you doing tonight?
It's fine.
How are you doing tonight, Greg?
That's fine, Chuck. Yeah, Greg is fine. Yeah, pleased to be able to speak with you. You and Bob, yes.
Well, we appreciate you taking the time today. That's for sure. So I'm going to get right into this, and I'm not going to dissect your book chapter by chapter. I don't want to do that. I want to give people an idea as to why, and this is going to sound unfair, but bear with me. Why should I bother to read this book? Okay. This is the problem with so many books having been released in this subject. And, spoiler, I'm going to tell you, yeah, this book is worth reading. So let's prove it to the audience, Greg, because again, as I said, a very understudied area. I was very happy to read things like JFK's Ordeal in Africa and other books which have gone into letting us know really what the general global political landscape was, letting us know what might have been in defiance of the military industrial complex's general agenda. And Indonesia, again, something that people might not think of, and I talk about Laos, I talk about Vietnam, I talk about, well, of course, the conflict between East and West Germany, Cuba, all of this. It is all something that must be put into context. And Indonesia, well, that might have a deeper historical root to it than even all that stuff I just mentioned. So help us out here. Why is Indonesia an important aspect to look at when examining Kennedy's overall foreign policy, and what did he do differently there than, say, oh, I don't know, the establishment was doing at the time, hint, everybody. Help us out.
Jack, I think Indonesia is not so well known in USA, is it? And I think that's probably why people haven't come up with a link before between Kennedy and Indonesia. I wasn't looking at Kennedy at all. I'm an Indonesian history lecturer, Southeast Asian history lecturer. I was doing that for 15, 20 years before I realized the real importance of Kennedy in Indonesia, Kennedy's policy in Indonesia. And so I came to, first of all, I came to Indonesia, then Kennedy as a second, rather than the other way around. Why is Indonesia important? Well, it's just such a huge country. It's 300 million, almost getting towards 300 million. And it's 5,400 kilometres, 3,500 miles, I think, one side to the other. It's a great big archipelago around the one-seventh of the equator. I think they're predicting it's, in terms of the economic strength, it's going to be one of the top countries in the world in another 20 years. But, of course, the Indonesia that we're looking at is the 1960s, and it's at the height of the Cold War. And perhaps the important thing about Indonesia in the 60s was that it had the largest Communist Party outside the Sino-Soviet bloc. That's one interesting point that people often forget or leave out. But Indonesia's importance then and today, huge, particularly for Australia, where I come from Australia. I've only been in USA, the last week, but it's good to speak with you directly in that respect. But Indonesia and Australia are neighbours. But when I say not so many people in the USA, in America, know about Indonesia, 10%, some journalists tell me. It's the same in Australia. I mean, we're right next to Indonesia over there, but many tourists visit Bali, many Australian tourists, but some actually visit Bali without even realising it's part of Indonesia, strangely. The Indonesian archipelago is rarely visited. It's always tourists visiting Bali. So,
well, let you take a pause for a second here, because it's important to note to the listener, majority of them are American listeners, just to be honest with you. But thing is, look, we've had the discussions on here about how geographically the average American can't even identify most parts of America, okay? And I get that. I understand that. When they think of Southeast Asia, we're always accustomed to hearing about Vietnam, and rightfully so, considering the horrific thing that went on there, which I consider to be an absolute crime altogether. But forget about my personal ideals here. Historically, we have a need to study this because it had a great effect on our society. But I still assure you that although the average American knows Vietnam by name, it's a war, it happened, here's when, they can't find that on a map either. Okay, yeah. So I get that, but
there
it's... Go ahead.
There is an interesting point, Chuck, about Vietnam, because when Indonesia came on side, I suppose, when Suharto took control in 65-66, that was considered such a big benefit for Western countries, well, for America at least, that they considered withdrawing then from Vietnam. That's how important Indonesia was regarded in Washington, that they were going to pull out of, you know, don't worry about Vietnam. They've got Indonesia, and that's the main prize, because it's like four times the size of any other country in Southeast Asia, Vietnam included. That's how important it was in economic wealth and population, in potential. It was huge. So, you know, once they got Indonesia on side, they said, forget about the rest, you know. It's we've got the main one now. The others will follow. That's how important Indonesia was in those days.
Well, right. And this is the fascinating thing, is we always need to remember that it's the business aspect of this that is key. Why do I say that? Well, all right. We have the simple idea that the military-industrial complex is definitely a money-making machine. We get that. But there is the other part of it where it is sort of the operational arm of greater corporate interests, whether they be Wall Street directly or they be the industrialists who play on Wall Street, who actually own things. This is the game, really. Why is Cuba even important? It's a tiny island. It's not really all that important, but it's a great place to grow fruit and sugarcane. Now, I'm just saying, and I know I'm bringing up all these other things, but I'm trying to put this in context to where, yes, indeed, today Vietnam is a thriving nation, right? It is becoming a greater player when it comes to business, when it comes to manufacturing, when it comes to, and in the very near future, we're going to see a lot come out of Vietnam, I think. But the thing about Indonesia is it was already large enough. It already had the population. It
already known.
Yeah, but see, again, it's not the thing that comes right to people's minds. Now, you even said, though, that in Australia, which is geographically, again, much closer, it's still not at the front of, say, the Australian's mind about, well, the historical significance of that time period. Would you just help me out and tell me why you think that is exactly? Or is it, is it because there was this interaction here between our intelligence services and their government and the regime that would end up dominating and did end up dominating at different times? Mm-hmm. And therefore, don't mention that because that's going to be an ugly thing.
One interesting thing, Jack, the second name, Alan Dulles, when I go through the records, the American records, government telegrams and whatever, again and again, I've seen Alan Dulles in a meeting, which is going to discuss Indonesia. He'd say, "All right, now, would the stenographer please go outside? We don't want any record on this meeting." Things like that. He'd cut short, so you never get the details of the meeting. You just get Dulles blocking out the recording or the transcript. So that's one reason I think Indonesia was never really known or didn't become known in America. There was a deliberate ploy to keep it out, to keep it away from people's awareness, you know? In records and in news items in the 60s, it was kept out. For example, when you mentioned Cuba before, I mean, we know about the problems that emerged in 62, 63 in Cuba with the missile crisis and the threat of nuclear war, things like that. Well, in Indonesia, there was a similar threat of nuclear war in 1962, but it was hardly even mentioned in America. The threat was between Indonesia and the Dutch arguing over sovereignty of West New Guinea, and Moscow was supporting Indonesia, Washington was supporting the Dutch, and that was coming closer and closer to nuclear confrontation, basically, and Kennedy didn't want that. Kennedy was trying to avoid that. He'd already confronted or had the problem of that right on his doorstep here in Cuba, and he wanted to avoid anything like that again, which is why he took the steps that he took. So I think there was one reason you could say Indonesia wasn't very well known in Australia. Well, it was far better known in Australia, I suppose, than America, because we did get the news, but we didn't get the proper story, you know, the actual story, what was happening. And in America, you've got only an outline of the story, put it that way, you know. But it was a nuclear threat, and when I say Kennedy faced one in Cuba, then another almost directly. Dulles was the person who set up both, you know, like the Bay of Pigs was arranged by Alan Dulles, and so was this confrontation in America. And I've been saying that the reason he's succeeded in Indonesia, the Dulles plan was the one that came out on top. Kennedy's did not. Kennedy's plan didn't survive, because even though the two were nuclear threats or nuclear threatening at the time, Kennedy didn't want a second threat in Southeast Asia. He was trying to solve the problems in Southeast Asia. He was adopting what I call a peaceable approach, you know. And in Vietnam, he didn't want to make his final decision on Vietnam until he'd sorted out what was happening in 62, 63 with Indonesia. And as soon as he had sorted that, as soon as he had sorted it out, or would have sorted it out in Indonesia, he was going to make the final decision on Vietnam, I think. He was planning to withdraw troops there, but nothing had struck the American public that we were going to pull out of Vietnam or nothing like that. It was still a plan, still an option, I think. Yeah. 1,000 troops were coming out before Christmas, I think it was, in 63. But in Indonesia, generally, it was not on the horizon, you know. It just wasn't on the... It wasn't in the news every day. It didn't occupy everybody's minds the same way that Cuba did, or the threat in Cuba. And it passed without people... It all happened without people knowing. The best example I can give is one of the chapters in the book about Alan Dulles starting a rebellion in 1958, and it wasn't even reported in the newspapers here. It just went by without people's awareness altogether, and yet it was huge, multi-millions of dollars outlaid. It was the second biggest costing covert operation outside Vietnam that they got involved in, and it wasn't even known. That's how well he kept Indonesia hidden. And I think that's carried on the last few decades. It's the reason Indonesian hasn't become sort of it's not on everybody's lips, you know. Indonesia is a beautiful place.
Fair enough. So here's what we'll do. You know, the context is easy to see here. Also, when you look at, like, say, Operation Ajax, which happened in Iran, we at least got treated to that in the States via the newsreels, things like this. But the issue that we did hear about some years later, other people wrote secondhand information about the overthrow in Indonesia, which took place and all that. That was not something that was fed through our news system the same way. Very little notation of it at all. And I think what we need to do here is get some context and put Indonesia in its place. Let's talk about what the circumstance was outside of the conflict and all of that. And actually, Bob Wilson has some questions, and we're going to take advantage of your knowledge on Indonesia directly. Good. Because I think it's important to lay out exactly what it is we're talking about here. Because, again... the context of, you know, the conflict in East and West Germany was known. The conflict in Cuba, which nearly came to a nuclear head, truthfully, is one thing. Mm. And also the problem in Vietnam, which, yeah, he had the withdrawal of 1,000 troops, but then all American personnel were supposed to be removed by the end of calendar year 1965, according to National Security Action Memorandum 263. Now, all of that and the contradictory statements in public which Kennedy was making, they're all part of the public record. But what was happening in Indonesia? Not so accessible unless you really dig. So, Bob, you have some questions regarding Indonesia directly, and I'd like to set the table, so to speak, so we know exactly what it is we're talking about. So go ahead, Bob Wilson.
Well, you guys have been setting the table well so far. Thank you. It's good to meet you, Professor Polgreen.
And, thank you.
As I was reading the book, JFK versus Alan Dulles, Battleground Indonesia, to belabor a point, in the title, you use the phrase Battleground Indonesia. So that's a clue as to how important this is going to be. And you guys have hashed out how, you know, Americans weren't really as aware of how large a country it is, the population and the resources. But something happened in 1936. Something was discovered over there. Can you talk about that a little bit? I hadn't heard of this until I read your excellent book with the foreword by Oliver Stone.
Yes, the name again, Alan Dulles, was a key name in what happened in 1936, because Dulles was the top legal representative for Sullivan and Cromwell. That's the, I call it the front desk of Standard Oil, Rockefeller Oil Empire. And Alan was the chief man in Paris at the time, doing deals with all sorts of people and roaming around Europe and over to England, over to London. What he did in 1935 was set up a company, a joint company with the Dutch, Netherlands and New Guinea, which is the western half of the island of New Guinea, which is the biggest tropical island in the world. I think it's Western New Guinea is bigger than California, I think, or is about the same size as California. So it's very big, 422,000 square kilometres. I mean, I forget what it is in square miles. But 1935, he set up this company calling it the Netherlands New Guinea Petroleum Company, NNGPM. Maatschappij is the Dutch word. So NNGPM was set up in 35. And in 36, a geologist by the name of Jean-Jacques Dozy and two others went climbing up the mountains there. The mountains are get up to 5,000 metres. You know, they're snow-capped mountains. There are glaciers there right on the equator, which is makes it an amazing place. But they found gold. Jean-Jacques Dozy found gold. And he found gold. It was the biggest discovery of gold ever. And it was the big... at the time, it was extremely rich. He brought back samples, and it tested at 15 grams per tonne. Now, in the pre-war days, the biggest gold area in the world was Witwatersrand in South Africa. It was 7 grams per tonne, so it was more than twice as rich as the richest gold mine in the world. And what he found was a great extrusion of ore just coming out of the earth. It was a mountain of ore, and he called it Erzberg, which is ore mountain. You know? And it was just smelling of richness. He said, he actually interviewed him in the Netherlands in 1982, I think it was. Went to his home in Den Haag, in The Hague, and spoke to him twice. And he told me there's the three of them, the three explorers we'll call them, were approaching this mountain. You could smell, it was so rich, you could smell the ore, you know, several kilometres away. That's how rich it was. It was just iron ore. It was copper, mainly copper, with gold sprinkled right through. And when he took that back, they were just amazed at how rich it was. And they were so surprised. They decided, and there were so few Dutch people in Netherlands, New Guinea, like 100 or so. It was almost free of Dutch people. Even they called it Netherlands, New Guinea for 100 years. There were no real Dutch settlements. The capital was a place called Manokwari, and just a few Dutch around the outside, a few hundred Dutchmen, that is, in all of Netherlands, New Guinea, and it'd been like that for a century. So they were worried with the threat of war in Europe and the threat of war with Japan. They were worried if they announced this huge gold mine, this gold discovery, it would be a lure for people to come down. In fact, Hitler and Germany both expressed interest in, they must have found out about it, because they both expressed interest in leasing Netherlands, New Guinea entirely, you know, before the war. So, which probably, there's no indication that they knew about the gold, but I think from that offer or the request to take New Guinea out of the Dutch hands, that they found out about its potential in natural resources. So that's amazing that we have Standard Oil's legal representative in Europe setting up the company that found this gold. The NNGPM was 60% American and 40% Dutch. And that had never happened before in the whole history of the Netherlands East Indies. The Dutch were the lords of the whole terrain. You know, it had never happened that the Americans got 60% in a joint company. And Dulles was the one who did it. And John Rockefeller, I think, just before World War II, the old man Rockefeller, he wrote a book. And in it, he praised Allen for the amazing sort of steps he'd taken to promote Standard Oil, to extend the empire. In those days, this was pre-war, and he said, thank you, you know, thank you very much, and, you know, you've done so much to help Rockefeller Oil. It's amazing. He'd helped in many other areas in the world. He's only a young lawyer, but he's brilliant. There's no doubt about it. He was a brilliant lawyer. He was a brilliant man. I remember when he was 8 years old, he wrote a book about the Boer War in South Africa in the turn of the century. That's not bad for an 80-year-old, is it?
Not bad for a 50-year-old. But these families, the Dulleses and the Rockefellers, like in your book, you mentioned like that they intermarry. Like to me, that it was it's a fact, but it's no small fact. And then he's like involved with being a lawyer for their interests in Indonesia. Am I correct in assuming, as I try to grasp the book from your wonderful work, colonialism was not becoming manageable in a different way, and you had a Kennedy who was a more humane man? Chuck brought up as we were speaking before the show, and he was reminding me of how Kennedy had he'd been over there, and he'd been seen what went on firsthand, and he was had a more humanitarian eye towards the land, and at the same time, Dulles was more Machiavellian. And meanwhile, you had this gold deposit, which you, in the book, it's very interesting to read about it and hear you speak about it now. But there was two times the amount of gold as the next largest deposit or source in the world. So what was going on? Like now colonialism was coming to a head in so many places. Could you talk about that in the Cold War?
Yes. Well, I should have also mentioned when he found the Ertsberg, when Jean-Jacques Dozy, the Dutch geologist, found the Ertsberg, which was, twice as rich as South Africa. One mile up the road, they call it an alpine valley, 1.5 miles up there, he also discovered what he calls a Grasberg. And he sat down and he drew the Grasberg, and then in the distance he put this big extrusion, and that was the Ertsberg. But the two within striking distance, they're the same ore body, and one just poured out of the earth and made a great mountain of ore. But the other one, the Grasberg, he actually said in 1936 it was covered in this strange grass, and he said there must be some sort of ore under there. He didn't do any digging, but he did say that's probably another prospect for gold right there, right in front of him as he's making the drawing. And the Grasberg has come out to be, huge, absolutely huge. And that's the one that they're now mining, Freeport McMoRan, or Freeport Indonesia is a branch of Freeport McMoRan. A Freeport director told me that it's got so much ore, so much gold there. There's 200 years of mining. 200 years. So he knew about the gold. Alan Dulles knew about the gold. But Kennedy, when he became president and was faced with the difficulty of supporting the Dutch if they wanted to keep New Guinea and angering the Indonesians who had the backing of Moscow, Kennedy didn't know about the gold or the oil. There was oil as well. But neither did President Sukarno of Indonesia. He did not know about the gold or the oil. So it's a strange situation where they were arguing. The Dutch and the Indonesians were arguing over sovereignty of West New Guinea, but they didn't really bring into the discussion or the argument the actual natural resources of the territory. They just had no part in the argument. In fact, they said it was almost worthless, would you believe? They said it had a lot of trees and a lot of water and not much else. They had the gold, and the Dutch elite knew about the gold because I interviewed the Dutch foreign minister, who was NATO minister at the time, 1982, I think that was, Jean Luns, L-U-N-S. Yeah? His name was Joseph Luns, head of NATO. But he was Dutch foreign minister for 16, 17 years, and his job was to keep West New Guinea Dutch, and that was exactly what he stayed foreign minister position for so long doing. Yeah? He knew about the gold, and we had quite a long talk, a 90-minute talk, and during that talk he thumped his fist on the table saying it was the richest deposit of gold, and it went on like that. So he definitely confirmed he knew about the gold. Dulles knew about the gold, and that was another argument that was happening because the Dutch was... Luns was trying to get the American company, Freeport, to go joint exploration or joint development together. But Lunds was told, no, Freeport will get the gold, and we're going to kick you Dutch colonials out, and we'll have it to ourselves without any Dutch interference. And that's what happened.
I apologize. Continue.
No. That's right.
I just wondered, it's amazing to read this in the book. It has the makings of a movie in it, almost with the duplicity and the darkness of some of these people. Now, you talk about Freeport Sulfur. What hit me as I was learning of this and reading your book, one of the people in 1998, I think his career with them began, you know, no less than Henry Kissinger is working for them. So you're having like major players involved in this, as you're saying, the American people who are supposed to be able to vote and have a say in their government and make, you know, informed decisions. This basically Alan Dulles is concealing this from us. And you have this huge, I'm just painting this like for the average listener who hasn't read the book yet, huge deposit of gold in this underdeveloped land. But in my mind, so they find this gold. They don't really, you say it's very highly elevated, you know, high up. They don't really have the technology to mine it at that time. And World War II hits.
Yeah.
So basically World War II hits. If you want to take it up from there a little, if you want to flesh it out a bit for me. World War II hits. These guys have it, and they're like, well, okay, you're saying basically we got to keep this under the cover now, and World War II hits, and they're just waiting, so they must be salivating, am I correct?
Right. One other thing I want to add in, Greg, if you don't mind, is because of the time period that Bob is picking here, if you wouldn't mind dropping in a bit of a mention of the fact that Alan Dulles has a brother.
And, John Foster, yes.
Yeah, John Foster Dulles, because I think that plays a significant role, but your opinion might vary here. So if you could introduce that in along with Bob's question, if you don't mind.
Yeah. Well, John Foster was the one who married into the Rockefeller family. Alan didn't. Alan got married shortly before World War One.
World War One, yeah.
They were both key figures in World War One. They both participated in the Versailles Treaty after World War One. Alan in intelligence, and John Foster was forging ahead with his career as well. And in the Second World War, they both played very important roles as well. John Foster at that time was in charge of actually distributing U.S. weapons, I think, to the Dutch, but he didn't do it fast enough, and that's what helped the Japanese take control of the Indies. Alan was in OSS, that's the precursor of the CIA, and he played an amazing role in Switzerland, came back, and when John Foster was in the under Eisenhower in the 50s, John Foster was Secretary of State, Alan was CIA director or director of Central Intelligence. And so that was sort of in a nutshell what their positions were in the US. But John Foster, he was a very important character. But I get the impression that most American readers consider them sort of close brothers, in the way that the Kennedys were close brothers, which they were. But John Foster and Alan were really quite different. Well, I mean, John Foster was a Presbyterian devout, used to go to church every Sunday. Alan was completely the opposite. He was married, but he had girlfriends all his life as head of the CIA. He had many affairs, let's say, many affairs. It didn't seem to bother people in those days, as it does with more recent CIA directors who, I think, had one affair and lost his job, I think. But Alan was made it a part of his life anyway. So they were two brothers, younger. Alan was the younger, and but he was quite different in terms of his temperament and approach to life. And people think they were working hand in hand or hand in pocket, whatever. But as I show in a book in 1958 in the rebellion, they weren't. Alan was actually tricky, very tricky. And John Foster had the approach where he'd say, well, I think you're being tricky, but I don't want to know about it, thanks. You know, just do it and then tell me the result. That was his approach. Whereas Alan was the one who was the master of covert activities. But that's jumping at 58. Back in 36, and the war, World War II was threatening, they'd found gold. That is, NNGPM had found gold, and the Dutch elite knew there was gold, and yes, they kept it quiet. They also had found oil, by the way, in just before 1941, just before the Japanese invasion in Southeast Asia. The Standard Oil put over some, did some exploration work right near the nose. New Guinea Island is shaped like a bird, huh? And the bird's looking to the west, and just 5 miles from the nose, the very nose of the bird, they found this oil, very rich oil, and it was in a well that produced 23,000 barrels from one well, 23,000 barrels a day. That's a record of the time. And to put that in perspective, 23,000 is about a quarter of the size of the famous Spindletop discovery in Texas, I think it was, years ago. That was sort of often cited as the biggest oil discovery ever, but this was 23,000 barrels a day. And General Douglas MacArthur was going to use this oil for his onward path to Japan, you know? And he organised more than 3,000 engineers to go over to exploit the oil. But then suddenly it stopped. The whole policy of exploiting the oil stopped. So that in the 1950s, this amazing discovery of oil just seems to just disappear, you know, as though it didn't even exist. And the reason that happened was people did not want the Dutch colonial government to benefit from that oil, and it was kept out of their control, basically, by oil companies. And so there was very rich oil waiting when eventually Indonesia took over West New Guinea in the 60s, and then the government changed and Suharto came into power in the 70s. That's when the oil was finally brought to the surface, and that's when the gold was finally mined, finally came into production in the 70s, 72, 73. The gold and the oil together started producing. But that's why it's a difficult book in a way to comprehend, because we're going from the 30s to World War II to the 70s, and it's just so rich. The richest oil in Southeast Asia. They had gas as well. One of the gas discoveries at the time, in 1958, there was a Dutch destroyer just practicing with a few depth charges. And they dropped a depth charge, and up came oil and gas, you know. They couldn't even stop it. It was so prolific. So they knew there was gas as well. And years later, they brought the gas up. It's now British Petroleum, who's got the control of the gas. And it's one of the biggest gas fields. It's the same as the ones in some of Siberian gas, you know. And so you've got such a rich country, gas, oil, biggest gold mine in the world. Then you get, on top of that, you get the Papuan people who live there, who are the most, it's just a sad fate that they've got the richest people. It was Richard Nixon, I think, who described it as the richest piece of real estate in the world, you know. So what Bob was talking about was keeping it quiet, keeping this amazing potential of natural resources quiet. So when the war ended in the 40s, and then the struggle started for Indonesian independence, and they got independence in 49, the Dutch kept New Guinea. Of course they'd keep New Guinea. It was so rich, they were not going to let New Guinea go. They were forced to let the archipelago go. Washington threatened to withdraw their post-war reconstruction aid unless they relinquished sovereignty of the archipelago. But the Dutch got a little bit tricky there, and the last minute they kept New Guinea. And then the struggle started for the next 10 years or 12 years over between Indonesia and the Dutch over they wanted New Guinea. Initially, Sukarno didn't really shout out much about West New Guinea, but he had a little bit of push from certain oil companies, and then the real struggle started in the mid 1950s. He was shouting out saying, you know, we want back West New Guinea, we don't trust the Dutch. It's like holding a knife to our throat, he'd say, if the Dutch colonial presence stays in West New Guinea. So, you know, it was, I think the Indonesian opposition to the Dutch continued the Dutch colonial presence in West New Guinea was pushed along, you know. In fact, I interviewed two Indonesian former foreign ministers, and one fellow in his house, I remember sitting with him talking in his house, and he had cardboard boxes full, and I looked over and it was all this amazing top secret, you know. He brought all these records back that he should have put in the archives, but he had them sitting in the corridor in his house, you know. And he told me that Indonesia was receiving millions of dollars secretly from, he wouldn't say whether it was the CIA or the oil company, you know, but one of the two. He said, you know, well, what's the, you know, is there a difference? But there was a difference, but he was told me that they were receiving lots of money supporting the Indonesian case against the Dutch presence in West New Guinea. So the Indonesians certainly were getting help from, we'll say Standard Oil, I think. Standard Oil was providing lots of money to support the Indonesian, to fuel the Indonesian anger against continued Dutch colonial presence. They kicked them out in 62, 63, but that's another story. We'll come to that, I'm sure, Bob.
Well, I wanted to ask, in your book, it was an interesting quote. You had said that the failures that Dulles had to the, you know, to the naked view were not actually failures. And it's just like there's two policies going on here. And Kennedy's policy is quite different than Dulles's policy. He doesn't know about this gold. And as Fletcher Prouty once said, Kennedy's problem was he thought he really was the president. And I'm assuming by that he meant he knew something about, you know, some of what you're bringing up here. And I guess that was the danger to Kennedy. And I just wanted to ask, on 11/20/63, in all of this, you brought up that a very interesting thing had been planned for, I believe, 1964. Can you please talk about that?
Yes, well, that's really was the death knell for JFK. Kennedy put his neck out because he wanted to make his Southeast Asian policy, foreign policy, a success. And he had to get Indonesia on side to make a success, because Indonesia's, as I said, four times bigger than anything else in Southeast Asia, any other country. So he got Kennedy invited over. Well, Sukarno met Kennedy in 1961 in Washington. He flew over, and the two of them got along quite well. And Sukarno was a brilliant orator. He talked for hours, and he just kept people so entertained, and they didn't want him to go. And I think that Kennedy was, you know, had some quite a strong, good ability in public speaking as well, and that could be one reason why they got along well. But I do remember one of the Indonesian journalists who accompanied Sukarno at the time, he told me when Sukarno came into the White House and met Kennedy and Jackie, Kennedy said, look, we can't talk here because I think the CIA had got this room bugged. So they had to go into the bedroom. So Jackie and President Kennedy and Sukarno sat on the big bed and jumping around a little bit, you know, just, you know, Sukarno was quite amazed that he'd been invited in. But apparently that was the only place Kennedy said was safe from being bugged, listened to, you know, by the CIA, which is quite a shock. And he got along quite well with Sukarno, and no other foreign leader had ever been invited in, you know, to the bedroom like that, into the safe place where they could talk. And Sukarno also got a helicopter, I think. He did request to meet Marilyn Monroe, which he did, and a few other points. But the helicopter, I think, really, he really felt like an honoured guest after he received the helicopter. But that established a link between Kennedy and Sukarno. And Sukarno was a nationalist, and Kennedy knew he was a nationalist, you know. And on that basis, he later supported him as much as he did. The interesting thing was, as soon as the sovereignty dispute was settled in 1962, the sovereignty dispute over West New Guinea, Kennedy intervened and he said to the Dutch, "I'm sorry, you'll have to leave, go back to Holland." That was the end of Dutch colonial rule in for 300 years. And he gave West New Guinea to Sukarno. But that's only half the story. Kennedy's full intention was to use that as an introduction and then have very beneficial effect. Kennedy's idea of beneficial was to pour in US aid into help Indonesia in a very big way, civic projects. And by that means, he was hoping to reduce the attraction of Indonesian peasantry or poor people to join the Communist Party. The Indonesian Communist Party was the biggest Communist Party outside the Sino-Soviet bloc. But they were all rice farmers, you know. They were absolutely poverty-stricken rice farmers who weren't actually political at all. They just wanted a bit of land, you know. So they joined the local, they call it PKI, Partai Communist Indonesia. So they joined the local PKI to get, in the hope of getting a bit of land to grow a little bit of rice, you know. But that was the extent of their communist activities, you know. But the point was, they would have voted for the PKI, and had Indonesia gone ahead with elections, the PKI would have been in a very strong position, because it would have been brought into government, brought into power, through electoral support of all these PKI supporters. And that was the problem facing people like Alan Dulles, who said to Kennedy at one stage, you know, we don't start befriending Sukarno, because you've got a problem there with the PKI. There are just too many PKI in Indonesia. So the only way to get rid of them is to, and we of course won't use force, you know, armed force, but that's the only way to get rid of them, he said. You know? That's a quote I use in the book.
Right.
Of course, they did use armed force in 1965, but that was after Kennedy. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, see, now, here's where we get into an interesting area, because Bob brought up Fletcher Prouty. And a lot of people only really that, you know, read the literature when it comes to the Kennedy assassination would say that they only know about Sukarno through the story that Prouty tells regarding Ed Lansdale, right? And the operation over there. And there seems to be a bit of confusion about this. So I wonder if you don't have to comment on Prouty's story, but if you could put that in a nutshell.
I wrote to him for several years, actually. I was corresponding with him.
Yeah. Okay.
So he helped me quite a lot. In fact, he said he was the man who told me that the CIA spent so much on that 1958 rebellion. It was their biggest outlay apart from the Vietnam War. So that's saying something, because I think Allen arranged for the 7th Fleet to be part of his plans there as well. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that when things changed in Indonesia, it was a fellow called Sterling Cottrell. Sterling Cottrell took over as he wasn't ambassador, but he was, well, in the role of ambassador for a few weeks. And that's when that rebellion started. Prior to that, we had the ambassador from he was the top State Department Southeast Asian official. I keep forgetting his name, but he was a friend of Sukarno, and the rebellion would not have gone ahead had Dulles not arranged things in 1957 to get rid of him. And Ambassador Allison, he was. Right. And basically, when Alan Dulles managed to get him kicked out, Ambassador Allison was kicked out. And then before the rebellion began, this fellow called Sterling Cottrell took over, and that's when the rebellion started. Sterling Cottrell was the superior for Lansdale. He was his boss, basically. And after, because Stirling Cottrell played a really important role, he was only there for a few months, really, or weeks, months. But what he did was inform the head of the Indonesian army, General Nasution, what was happening with this, when this rebellion was starting. See, what I'm saying about this rebellion is that Alan Dulles set it up to fail. And people, unless people want to read chapter 4, they'd probably say, he wouldn't do that, he wouldn't start a rebellion just to fail, you know. But he did, because the outcome of that failed rebellion was the Indonesian army was then in a very strong position, and it was unified. Before that, the Indonesian army was not unified. It was spread all over the place, over the archipelago. So the result of that rebellion was unification of the army, and it became the strongest opposition to the rising PKI. And the second point was the Indonesian army then turned towards, and this is what Fletcher Prouty told me, they then turned towards Dutch New Guinea with the army and the PKI. They were both anti-Dutch, and they kicked out the Dutch. But without the army, it wouldn't have happened. They needed a unified army to kick out the Dutch, and that's what Alan Dulles wanted. He wanted the Dutch out because he wanted to replace the Dutch with Sukarno, and 30 months later, Sukarno was out. So he's already planning Sukarno's demise while Kennedy's handing over Western New Guinea to Sukarno. Dulles, on the other hand, was already planning his demise. And as soon as they finished this 1962 squabble over sovereignty, what started was another anti-colonial squabble between Indonesia and the British in Malaya. And they call this confrontation or confrontasi. The British were decolonizing in Malaysia or Malaya, and Malaysia came out of it, of course. That was the British idea. And Sukarno, he did not start confrontasi. But everybody in Malaysia today would accuse him of starting confrontation, and probably half the people in Indonesia too. But I found out from various interviews and archival records that Sukarno did not start confrontation. And U.S. Ambassador Jones told, who was there from 1958 on to way up to 65, he was the man who told President Kennedy Sukarno did not start confrontasi, and on that basis, Kennedy agreed to make a visit to Jakarta. That's what Bob was saying before, 1964, and they agreed they're going to Sukarno. Even though he didn't start confrontasi, he couldn't stop confrontasi either. He needed Kennedy's assistance, and the two of them were going to get together in Jakarta and stop confrontation. Now, had that happened, had Kennedy made the visit over to Indonesia in 64, early 64 he was planning, and stopped confrontation, then Alan Dulles' plans for regime change and getting control of the gold and the oil and benefiting from all the natural resources of Indonesia, it all would have just gone down the drain. And he had a plan for regime change that involved eliminating the PKI, which is what happened in 65, 66, and by that means even splitting Moscow and Peking. But we'll probably get onto that later.
Right.
But had Kennedy made that trip to Jakarta in 64, all hell would have been loose for Alan Dulles. And even though Alan Dulles wasn't in power, he was kicked out, as you know, in 61, end of 61, for his role in Bay of Pigs. He was still very, very powerful, very powerful. He had so many different networks operating.
Well, he would continue to be powerful even after he left the corridors of power, so to speak, because, you know, we're going to get to later how Alan Dulles effectively was the most active member of the Warren Commission. You know, we're going to have to touch upon that at some point. But really quickly, before we go to break here, because we're gonna take a break and give us a chance to recollect our thoughts once again, and go further with this very dense piece of work. Again, we're speaking to, and Bob Wilson and myself, are speaking to author Greg Polgrain, who is the author of JFK versus Allen Dulles, Battleground Indonesia. Okay, that's the whole title of the book. Two pictures on the front there, one of Kennedy and one of Dulles. Well, big surprise there, right? But it's put out by Skyhorse. I make jokes like that. Sorry, Greg. You know, no problem. I like it, actually, when a book has on the front of it what should be. You know, the contents. We're going to speak to it, so therefore, here's the pictures. Good. But anyway, in the context of the time, just before we go to break, there's something to be said for the anti-colonial sort of zeitgeist, I would say, that was ever present for a couple of decades, it seemed like, because whether organic, manufactured, fabricated in one way or another, or some variation thereof, there was a great deal of anti-colonialist activity, which could be either, again, seized upon by those that wished to benefit for financial gain or for the gain of leverage of future resources, etc. Obviously, military strategic positioning in a global sense, all of this in play, but really made easier by the sort of spirit of the time that seemed to be about setting aside the colonial yoke, if you will, in various nations which had been dominated by either empires or other effective colonialists. Like, I would not say the Dutch had an empire, but they certainly were effective colonialists at one point. So what do you say about that, though? Just the nature of that time period also playing Kennedy, into this story. Yeah, go ahead.
Kennedy was aware of this anti-colonialism. After World War II, anti-colonialism was, colonialism had the death knell, put it that way. It was Dien Bien Phu in Vietnam was one, but the anti-colonial feeling really came to the fore in Indonesia just after World War II and up to 1949. Indonesia was battling against the Dutch. Huh? Mm-hmm. They had the struggle for independence, 45-49 struggle, which was pure anti-colonialism. And the Dutch, they thought the Atlantic Charter was just like a wartime strategy, but when the war ended, the Dutch colonial power decided to come back, and they were fighting basically to maintain their pre-war status. Huh? But Kennedy, on the other hand, in the early 50s, even as a senator, I think it was, when did he give that speech on Algeria, talking about he wasn't looking at colonialism in the way that John Foster Dulles was. Dulles was thinking of sort of like rearranging the deck chairs, and then coming up with another solution, but basically the same power would be in control of the same country, etc. But Kennedy was saying, no, it's, independence for these colonial countries is the way history is going to roll. And of course he was correct, because he'd gone into that in some detail. He knew, he'd read the history books, he'd been to Vietnam and spoken with various people before he got on the ground information. Mm-hmm. And he realized that even Ho Chi Minh was supporting his quest was what the one that was had the support of the bulk of the people, I think.
Oh, I've always found it amazing that Ho Chi Minh was actually surprised that there was American opposition, because he wrote himself that he felt as though it was much in the spirit of the American independence movement itself.
Yes.
And a lot of people forget about that. Oh, that's just the commie leader, No, this guy thought that he was, and again, communism was a choice, even, or some form of it, and it didn't necessarily have to be opposed. See, that was the interesting thing that Kennedy had there, not just about the domino effect and domination, but...
And also Sukarno formed his own political party back in the 20s on the day of American 4th of July, in recognition. So he knew, he'd read all the American novels and history books, and he could talk for hours, talk for days with Kennedy about American history. Not many foreign leaders could do that.
You know? Is he another one who might have found it surprising that there was American opposition to, I don't know, him or his nation determining their own destiny, so to speak. Yeah. Anyway, we're going to take a break now, but we are speaking to Greg Polgrain, who is the author of JFK versus Allen Dulles, Battleground, Indonesia. And it is an extremely important and undercovered circumstance that we're discussing. And we're going to get into the assassination and all that in the next hour. Stick around. Bob Wilson is with me also. The Ocelli Effect continues after this.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, she knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
The War State by Michael Swanson explains the great national transformation that took place and put the Kennedy presidency in the context of the times and reveals never-before-published information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy would not have been assassinated if he had been president 200 years ago. His assassination took place in the context of the Cold War and the rise of the national security state. Before World War II, the United States was a continental republic. In the decade that followed, it became an imperial superpower. Generals such as Curtis LeMay not only wanted to invade Cuba, but knew that there were short-range missiles on the island armed with nuclear warheads that they could not destroy because they were on mobile launchers. Their invasion could have led to a third world war, and they wanted to go to war anyway. The War State by Michael Swanson reveals why and will show you what President Kennedy was up against. For more information, thewarstate.com.
Like history, real history, that you were never taught in schools. Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia. By author Mike Swanson, with new documentation never seen before. That'll open your eyes to events that led up to this. Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia, 1945 through 1961. Get your copy today at Amazon.com. Why? The Vietnam War by author Mike Swanson.
Every time I put it on my face, I'm able to breathe just a little bit deeper. What are people saying about MyTrueEssence.net?
I'm going to tell you something serious, man. I just want to tell your listeners, I bought some of that Modifilin from Christy, and she made me up some of this emu oil mixed with some other stuff. I don't know what's in it, but I like the way it smelled. And I started putting it on, rubbing it on my foot, rubbing it on my knee, and like the second day, I just noticed it. I'm walking around, I'm like, damn, my knee is loose.
I can tell you that oil you gave me helped me with my carpal and my shoulder problem. And if it wasn't, I wouldn't be working.
My ankles sort of really be pesky and bother me. And I'm telling you, the pain just went away. Essential oils rule!
And when I put that on, it's like my skin came alive.
MyTrueEssence.net.
In denial. Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to larry-hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at amazon.com in digital or physical form.
Uncle, do you remember that time when Nibiru, also known as Planet X, was going to get within the gravitational pull of the Earth and cause mass commotion and chaos?
More of that. More commotion. More confusion. It goes into the confusion thing. Head going nut, he's going back, and it's going crazy.
I hate being confused like that.
But that's exactly how he wants it.
It is, but at the Ocelli.com radio network, you're never confused.
No, it's straight to the point.
Straight talk.
And I like that idea.
It's about time. Forget this Nibiru stuff and listen to the Ocelli.com radio network.
.com, and he'd get it right where you want to hear it at. Right straight ahead instead of ding-donging back and forth here.
Ocelli.com.
This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you're listening to The Ocelli Effect at Ocelli.com.
Revelation through conversation.
Second hour of the Ocelli Effect begins now. No matter who you are, where you are, when you are, welcome to it. And I don't want to spend any more time talking because I want to get right back to author Greg Polgrain, who wrote the book JFK versus Alan Dulles, or verse Alan Dulles, depending on, you know, your particular way of speaking. Right. Battleground Indonesia is the subtitle to it. But meanwhile, really information-dense book here. There is a lot to it, and let's go into a different direction. A lot of listeners might not be even familiar with this, but there was this gentleman named Dag Hammarskjöld, and he's an important figure in, well, a lot of stories. But for that, I'm going to go straight to, and also, by the way, Bob Wilson is with us, and he's going to be asking some questions in this hour for sure, and we'll see exactly how long Professor Polgrain's going to put up with us. But,
you're right.
You know, here we go. Dag Hammarskjöld, let's start there, and Bob Wilson will come in very shortly after that, but can you just, again, I hate to do this to you because it's a given. You understand who this is. I know who this is. A lot of American listeners are like, Dag Hammarskjöld, is that a cartoon character? They have no idea who this is. So
Swedish. He was Swedish. The name is Swedish.
Yeah.
He was the second UN Secretary General. First one was Norwegian, I think. He came in the early 50s, started, and they thought he was a mild-mannered. He would be a mild-mannered Secretary General, but he turned out to be really quite, he had a mind of his own. And he was aware of this great shift that we talked about before, about anti-colonialism sweeping the globe, you know. And he was, in the late 50s, he was deeply involved in helping the many countries in Africa achieve independence. All the old colonial countries in Africa were one by one shedding off the colonial shroud and getting their own independence. And then when Kennedy confronted or asked Hammarskjöld for help in to solve the problem over the Netherlands, New Guinea, Dutch New Guinea, yeah? Because Kennedy didn't want to be involved in that dispute between sticking up. He had to stick up for the Dutch, and when the weapons from Moscow arrived to support the Indonesians, you got that confrontation that I talked about, you know, before, about, which could have been a nuclear war, because the Russian support for, or Soviet support for Sukarno, and American support for the Dutch. So Kennedy said, hold on, he wants to hand this over to Hammarskjöld, and he gave it to the UN, but very, very quietly. He didn't want this known, because he wanted to keep Indonesia on side. He was trying to keep the Dutch on side too. They were NATO allies. So he asked if Hammarskjöld would be interested in implementing a policy that he'd started in Africa. He called it OPEC's Operation Executive. It was a new idea in decolonization that he'd started in Africa in two countries only. And the idea was, because some countries, like West New Guinea, didn't really have a strong infrastructure. They didn't have the indigenous people didn't have a bureaucracy. And this Operational Executive, OPEC's idea was, Hammarskjöld was going to supply half a dozen experts from the UN to help the West Papuan people build up their economy, build up their government. They'd stay there for 6 years and build up a viable economy. And by that means, their independence would become meaningful. Huh?
Right. Well, one thing quickly here, just for your opinion on this, do you think that the tightrope that Kennedy had to walk domestically regarding not appearing soft on communism, which often his critics said he was, played any role in this? Because seems like to me, you could easily, if you make a compromise even, appear to be soft on communism at the time. I mean, given the Cold War attitudes.
Yes.
This is definitely a significant factor as to why he might have handed this over to Hammarskjöld and kept it quiet, right?
Yeah. Well, he's soft. He could have been accused of being soft on communism, because he spoke with Sukarno, as he did. But Sukarno was branded as a communist by Dulles deliberately, you know. I mean, even Vice President Nixon said Sukarno was a nationalist. But Dulles had a louder voice, apparently, and kept on labelling him as communist. Kennedy knew Sukarno was a nationalist, but if he showed any support for what Sukarno was saying, he could have very easily, by his domestic enemies, said he's soft on communism. Anyway, Hammarskjöld decided he was going to grant independence to the West Papuan people and go ahead with this OPEC's idea of granting them independence and setting up their economy. Now, if that happened, the gold mine would have gone to, well, out of hand, out of the control of Rockefeller Oil, you know, out of their hands, and it would have angered Sukarno, would have angered the Indonesians if the Papuans were not incorporated as part of Indonesia. So trouble started in the Congo, and Dulles actually helped start that trouble, because he himself was involved in the assassination of the first president of the Congo. He was only president for 3 months, and the paper trail showed, the paper trail investigated years later by the Senate U.S. Church Committee in 75. They found that Alan Dulles was directly responsible for the death of Lumumba, the first president of the Congo. And when I read that in the late 70s, I thought, wow, that's, if Dulles was involved in the death of Lumumba, then perhaps he could have been involved in the death of Hammarskjöld, you know? So I tracked down the Hammarskjöld's second man, his deputy, a fellow called George Ivan Smith. He'd retired at the time, living in a wonderful place in England, in the centre of England, in a wonderful old house, and went along to talk with him about the death of Hammarskjöld. And I spoke for about an hour and a half, and just as I was leaving the house, it turned out that I started talking about George Ivan Smith and, you know, where he grew up and stuff like that. And he came from Brisbane in Australia. I didn't realise. Oh. And, of course, that's where I come from. So we had this immediate link that we both came from Brisbane. So he said, oh, you better come back, you know, come back next week. So I said, okay. And it was the second visit where he told me that how close Hammarskjöld was with this Papuan business, how he'd been really more... He was more interested in Papua, in solving this problem with the Cold War, involving the Soviets and Kennedy and everything, more interested in that than he was in the Congo, he said, which puts it on a scale of importance for you, huh? Right. So the gist of it was that he thought Hammarskjöld was assassinated. So after that, I started looking more closely at the assassination of Hammarskjöld. And it turns out that Hammarskjöld went over to the Congo to sort out some dispute at the time between, you know, secessionists and French and English mercenaries were involved. And right. Anyway, the plane that Hammarskjöld was travelling in was brought into Elizabethville, I think it was. It was left unattended for a period of 4 hours before it took off for a night flight up to a place called Ndola, and it crashed in landing just after midnight. It crashed. But my point is, for those 4 hours, the plane was unattended, and I'm saying someone got in to fiddle with the altimeter, and it was, when the plane was coming in at midnight, George Ivan Smith told me there was another plane, a small fighter plane, harassing it, and the pilot who took over the controls, he was one of the top pilots in the world, you know. He must have checked the altimeter and checked with the Ndola control tower that he was coming in. Another 3 minutes he would have landed, but the Ndola control tower gave him, I think they were involved because there was another book published. They said that all the recordings were missing and the voice recordings were turned off, and, you know, it was set up. So he landed, I think it was about 500 feet. He was 500 feet lower than the altimeter was showing, and he crashed into trees, and everybody on board, 16 or 17 people, were killed. And that ended Hammarskjöld's interference in the West New Guinea dispute. But it's very difficult to tell people. They all say, oh, no, he was killed because of what he was doing in the Congo. And I said, look, the person involved here was Alan Dulles, you know. And the first thing that they did when they got to the wreckage of the plane was to rip out the altimeter. They sent it back for check, back to USA to check. And the FBI man, Edgar, what's his name? J. Edgar Hoover. He was the one who said, oh, no, the altimeters are working fine. Or, you know, there was no tampering, no suggestion that anybody had played with them. He was the man who gave the okay. So people seem to dispense with the idea that the altimeters had been fiddled with because J. Edgar Hoover said they weren't. Right? Now, I think that there is an investigation started a few years ago, that's 50 years later, by the UN, looking into this, the death of Hammarskjöld. They decided that it was not just an accident. So they're slowly getting around, but they're hoping to get records from the CIA, but I think they won't. But right. My argument is Hammarskjöld was killed because he was interfering in the West New Guinea dispute, and it would have ruined the whole idea of regime change in Indonesia had he done that, and it would have taken the gold directly out of the hands of the Rockefeller's oil empire, put it that way.
Well, and it does fit.
Hammarskjöld had to go.
Yeah, and it does fit perfectly with the behaviors of the time of the agency, and Dulles being directly involved in many of them, where individuals who were inconvenient, okay, or standing in the way of a particular agenda, even if an assassination is not directly arranged, sometimes the circumstances are. Like, for instance, I mean, it is not CIA people that directly assassinated Lumumba, in my opinion, but that was arranged so that it could happen.
One was.
Right.
One guy was given instructions to do it, but he didn't actually do it. He got somebody else to do it.
Right. So, but what I'm saying is, either way, he sets in motion the circumstances. You don't have to necessarily arrange, because some people go, well, how many murders can they? No, you don't have to. You can simply arrange the circumstances. I mean, you know, you remove the guards. You give the information to the opposition. You do what you do with Lumumba, which is let him get tracked down by the people that wanted a piece of him. Very simple, and you don't even need to employ the assassin directly. The plane, you give them a problem going in for a landing. Well, gee, now they don't know exactly where their canopy is for the trees.
Yeah.
So
there
you go. Problem takes care of itself, so to speak. And with that in mind, just for a bit of context, again, I want to call on Bob because, we mentioned Africa here, but there were other nations in play. And look, they're not necessarily directly related to the circumstance here, but it gives you a sense of what's going on. So, Bob, you have a question about, I think, Nasser that you want to bring up, but also there's something else. So I'll turn it to you for a couple of minutes here before we move on, because I want to get... if you're a reader of Kennedy literature, you're going to be well aware of the name De Morenshield. Oops, I said it. We're going to get there. Okay. So, Bob, let's put a little more context on this before we get to, I guess one of the dirtier details. Excuse me for the way I described this, Greg. It's always amazing to me when people do very cursory searches of these things and they get an idea and they never develop it. You actually develop these things, so I want to get your take on that. But, Bob, for a little more context on this and what we should consider about the action of the time, how about what was going on with Egypt and all that? Go ahead.
Thanks, Chuck. Our friend Professor Joan Mellon did a book on the sinking of the USS Liberty, which I bring in from, I would imagine you're familiar with that, of course. But, she actually said that they were carrying a nuke in one of the ships over there and had headed it towards Egypt and Nasser. I was thinking of that as you guys were speaking and such of her accounting of that. These people, Nasser, Lumumba, Sukarno, you're saying they weren't communists, but could you speak a little bit more to Nasser in particular? And then I was just wondering about anything about the Liberty you might know, because she wrote that book.
No, I don't know about the Liberty, but I know. Well, Nasser was part of, non-aligned countries. It's a very important development that came about in mid-50s, 1955. And Sukarno was one of the main figures putting the non-aligned movement together. And it was a movement that was trying to take one step away from this Cold War confrontation between East and West. The non-aligned movement was a worry, a big worry for people like John Foster Dulles. He used to say, if you're not with us, you're against us, you know. But the non-aligned movement, Nasser was a big name, Tito, Sukarno, Nauru, who else? I think they were the main figures. But... And Nasser was such a leader. He was, stood out, didn't he? But as far as the Liberty and things like that, no, can't add much to what the book would have said already. But it was a key I do remember Sukarno and was his deputy, I think his foreign minister, was heading off in a plane. They actually off to a non-aligned meeting. Where was that? I forget whether it was in Cairo or whether it was in Algeria, I think. Anyway, at the last minute, they found out the plane that they were going to travel on would have blown up and destroyed. So it was an attempt to assassinate Sukarno again. There were about five or six actual attempts to get rid of Sukarno, and they all came to nothing. One of them was pretty direct. It was actually in Jakarta. It was at Cikini, and it was in a school, and there were hand grenades thrown at Sukarno by, well, they said they caught the people and accused them of being linked with Muslims. But I think the CIA at the time was giving money to that Muslim group, and that was probably one of the attempted assassinations that was, you could probably trace back to CIA. Yeah? But the actual hand grenades that exploded, I spoke with the man who was right next to Sukarno when the hand grenades, several were thrown. He pushed Sukarno over on the ground and lay on top of him to protect him from the blast. And he was, after that, he was immediately promoted. And he enjoyed a good position for the rest of his days in the army, but he ended up in army pensions. army pension, distributing the pension. That is a good job. But Sukarno said basically thank you for saving his life, you know. But that did shake up Sukarno quite a lot. So, yeah, that gets us back to the Indonesia, I suppose. What year are we up to, really? In the 60s, we've gone through with the sovereignty dispute, 62. Kennedy handed over West New Guinea to Sukarno, and then straight away was met with confrontation and had a problem pushing through his attempt to befriend Indonesia or to placate Indonesia by putting in US aid, because when Indonesia was in conflict with the British in Malaya, then the US Senate said, we're not going to supply, you know, US economic aid for Sukarno if he's in dispute with our allies, the British allies. So they stopped Kennedy's plan to support Sukarno, to support Indonesia. And that was the plan he had in mind, to basically bring Indonesia on side in the Cold War. So that was a desperate shock facing Kennedy. And that's why Kennedy decided he himself had to visit Jakarta to bring confrontation to a stop. Mm. That's why he made that desperate visit, or he was going to make that desperate visit. He probably would have won the Nobel Prize for Peace, because he was bringing confrontation to a stop, and he needed that a success before his re-election. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been re-elected at all. He didn't stand a chance. But had he gone there, stopped confrontation, he would have probably picked up the Nobel Prize and romped home in the election, yeah? Second term election. But he was prevented from leaving. And the person who said that in his book was Ambassador Jones. He said, you know, an assassin stopped Kennedy from making that trip to Jakarta. Well, you can interpret that two ways, of course, but he stopped him deliberately from making that trip, not just by the way.
I would say that is not the only thing that was stopped on November 22nd, 1963, but we could spend the next 3 hours going through that, just talking about the things that did not get done because of that. Well, look, Here's where I make the difficult, seemingly completely incoherent segue, because I want to make sure that we touch upon this. Since we bring up the assassination, since we talk about what was stopped, and I have already mentioned that I feel as though the Vietnam War would not have been prosecuted as it was, let's put all that aside and talk about the aftermath. Because the curious thing, and the thing that many authors enjoy bringing up, but never develop well, okay, is, with the exception of maybe somebody like Walt Brown, who has gone and laid out exactly how active Mr. Dulles is during the Warren Commission. I agree with his conclusion in his book, The Warren Omission, which I asked you if you read. You didn't, but that's okay. Maybe you'll get to it at some point. It's an interesting read.
Yes.
He's so active during the executive sessions and on the record that you might as well have called it the Dulles Commission. And some people point to that and say, look, he's part of the cover-up. I mean, you can agree because, honestly, it's blatantly obvious if you read the record. But he actually breaks it down and shows you how obvious it is in that book, which I appreciate. But anyway, enough of that. Back to what you see here. A curious figure in the Warren Commission is this gentleman, George DeMorenshield. Now, why is he a curious figure? Because he's linked directly to the alleged assassin. You know, the assassin that they had, what, three subcommittees on for the Warren Commission that were going to figure out exactly how much of the assassin he was out of four or five, right? Anyway, you know, is directly connected to this guy, George DeMorenshield. And again, Bob brought up author Joan Mellon. She also does an interesting job about talking about what DeMorenshield did in Haiti and stuff like that. A book called Our Man in Haiti. Fascinating thing about his interaction with the government down there. Well, DeMorenshield's got an interesting history. And DeMorenshield's got an interesting history. But here's the thing a lot of people might not know, and, well, you're going to wind up having to talk about. He's connected to Alan Dulles, too, which, you know, just coincidentally, by the way, I share a birthday with Alan Dulles.
Congratulations.
It's one of the, not really. It's one of those things that comes up every year, like, who do you have a birthday with? Alan Dulles, thanks. I'm happier that I share a birthday with Crazy Joe Gallo, which is also true. The same day he died, he was born and died on his birthday, and I was born that same day. But anyway, that I find more heartwarming than Alan Dulles. Okay. So, yeah, the gangster's better than the CIA guy, right? Okay. So, anyway, this is an interesting thing here. And I think it's often not appreciated. People will bring up that he was involved, that he was appointed to the Warren Commission, that he was involved. Maybe they know he was active. I don't think they know how active he was usually. But help me out here a little bit about this. Yeah.
The chief witness, DeMorenshield, had anybody been aware at that time that Dulles, Alan Dulles, had known George DeMorenshield from way back when he was about 10 years old. That's how far back their links go. When Alan was given instructions to renegotiate a Standard Oil contract in the Baku oil fields, that's just after World War One and just at the time of the Russian Revolution, because when the revolution was about to blow, the investment put in by Rockefeller into the Baku oil fields was going to be lost. So Alan was given the job of renegotiating with the Nobel brothers, who'd sold half their share, I think, in the oil shares to Rockefeller. So he went over to the Baku oil fields and was talking with the Russian boss there, who was DeMorenshield, but his original name, von Morenshield, and his young son, 10 or 12 years old at the time, was George. So Alan kept in contact with him. After that, the father was arrested, but he fled with young George and his mother, but his mother died. They went over to Poland for a year or two. George went through the cavalry for 18 months, I think. Then he went over to be a student in Belgium, and he stayed there. And when George DeMorenshield was in Belgium, Alan was in Paris, which is about an hour and a half by car away. Yeah? And I think George used to come down to Paris. When he was a student, he had a side business selling snow gear, clothes and things, you know? And he used to use the Russian emigre population, about 50,000, I think, in Paris at the time, having fled from the Russian Revolution, that is. And he used them. He used to go to a particular bistro or cafe or what do you call it? Yeah, a club up in Montmartre, I think. And that's where they used to meet. That's where Alan used to go and sing Cossack songs and whatever in the 1930s when he was living in Paris. He and I think he befriended, I can't find any information on that, but he gave any documentation, I should say, on that. But he did warn George de Montjoie the war was coming, and he helped with the immigration. George went to America, mm-hmm. and he played around for a while, about a year, selling this, doing that. Then he joined a company called Humboldt Oil. Right. And if you know Humboldt Oil, it's linked with the Bush family. And Alan Dulles was the lawyer for Humboldt Oil. So they were keeping in their friendship, I suppose. The Alan was like a godfather, I suppose. You could call him that. But he helped young George at the same time as he was helping another young person who's actually the same age, a fellow called Bernard, Prince Bernard. And he and George de Montjoie were the same age, and they're the same sort of characters in a way. They were the dashing, and sort of the ladies were keen to meet them, and Bernard was living in the house about a block and a half away from where Alan was living at the time. And the couple in the house, owning the house, was a fellow from the guard for the Tsar. He'd married American lady, the richest American lady at the time. What's her name? I forget. Alan. I forget her name. But she got her money from basically five husbands, and it was all through the legal office for Standard Oil. Huh? Okay. Anyway, to cut a long story short, George de Morenshield went to America, and he was working together with Alan Dulles in the 1940, just before America entered the war. Right. Alan and George were involved in selling oil to the Vichy French, working with Vichy intelligence agents, which came up in the Warren Commission, and I mentioned it. Right. But they didn't make clear that Alan was the lawyer for Humboldt Oil, and Humboldt Oil was really the employer for George de Morenshield. But that was how it was. I think he said Humboldt, but what they didn't mention in the commission was that Humboldt Oil was also doing the exploration at the same time, 1941, in West New Guinea, where they found that oil that I mentioned earlier. Right. That's Humboldt Oil. It did the exploration. So there's a link there with Humboldt Oil, Alan Dulles, the Bush family, if you want to bring them in, because I think that Grandfather Bush was the one who set up Humboldt. Humboldt had been taken over by Standard Oil 16 years earlier, secretly taken over, so that it was still standing. It was looked like it was standing alone as Humboldt Oil, but actually it was a Rockefeller subsidiary. So that's what the picture that you get from George de Morenshield. He was a close friend of Alan Dulles, and had that fact been known at the time of the Warren Commission, they would have just shut it down, surely, and started again, because they can't have the chief witness and the chief. What was Alan's position? Prosecutor or?
Well, no, he was his position. He was just one of the commission members, one of the seven
members.
And
but he did ask questions. Yeah,
and he was very active in asking questions. He basically controlled the majority of the interviews and the executive sessions where commissioners were present. So even though junior counsels asked questions, he would literally tell them to move on or to go further into things right there on the spot.
And George later admitted in that book that he wrote, Apache. Remember that? Yeah, the quote from Oswald.
Right.
He wrote a book before George de Morenshield was going to participate in that rehearing in the early 70s, I think. And he was found in his house with a bullet wound through his mouth, and he said he wasn't able to offer any new information.
Yeah,
that was on the morning of the hearings.
Right, he might have been interviewed by the House Select Committee had he not happened to shoot himself, allegedly, in his home, you know, or anyway. There is a story there.
The friend I mentioned, the Dutch journalist Willem Oltmans, who was the person who tracked down George de Moorenschot later and sort of got him out and got him willing to participate in that hearing again.
Right.
He said he didn't believe he killed himself, nor did George de Moorenschot's wife, Fomenko. Right? Her name was they were Russian emigres from the revolution, and his wife was Jeanette Fomenko, who became George de Moorenschot's wife. Fomenko is an interesting it's a it's a name with title in early Russia.
No, all of that is very interesting, but there's a nexus there where one can literally tie Alan Dulles, George de Moorenschot, and Prescott Bush together.
A direct link, a direct link.
A very direct one, despite the fact that Humble Oil was acting as an arm of Standard. You know, but there you go. This is how partnerships are. It really, quite frankly, is not even relevant who owns the thing on paper. It's more about who controls it. So, you know, there you have it. Very much like, you know, today we see, you know, a guy like Bezos can turn around and go get himself a tax break on his kids, even though he controls, like, the largest company on the planet up until a couple of days ago. You know, whatever. Who knows if that's real either. But the thing is, it's about who controls it, not necessarily who owns it. Although the people who actually control it are the people who really own it, but the paperwork might vary. Okay, so I know that sounds confusing, and we could get into that at another time, but we're down to the last 15 minutes or so, and we've covered a lot of ground here, and I just want to open it up to you to lay out whatever it is you think we've missed here that would be a key reason for somebody to read this book, because again, I'm going to remind people of the title, JFK versus Alan Dulles, Battleground Indonesia. Written by you. It's out there in paperback. It's out there in audio and Kindle. As I see, I have the paperback in my hand as I'm speaking to you. And again, information-packed book. And also I note on the back, just really fast, a blurb from one of my favorite authors, which is Jim Douglas. And so, you know, listen, there's an endorsement there. You have Oliver Stone writing the foreword. You have Jim DiEugenio writing the afterword. I forget what it's called, actually. The postscript, so to speak, is written by DiEugenio. So obviously, okay, just for the average reader out there, there's a lot of serious information here. And there are some people lending their names to this because they think this needs to be read. And guess what? Rare occasion, I agree with them. All of them.
I wanted to point people to Chapter 7. It was actually after Kennedy was killed, you know, in 63, 64, 65. You got the regime change. What happened in 65, 66 in Indonesia would not have happened had Kennedy made his trip to Jakarta and proceeded. I mean, what happened in 65, 66 in Indonesia is, I'm not sure whether people are fully aware of it, but 1.5 million people were killed in regime change. I mean, Indonesian army officers involved in the killing said, no, 3 million. 3 million were killed, you know, and we did a good job, because they're talking about killing the communists.
Right.
But the point is, as I pointed out earlier, was most of the people killed were rice farmers. You know, they weren't even political. You know, and they were killed. And people, it puzzles people to this day why so many were killed. And I've suddenly realised, and that's what I've got in Chapter 7, why they were killed, because the killing of the elimination of the Indonesian Communist Party, the PKI. Split, well, Russia and Sino-Soviet split had already started, but this really split them apart. the killing of the elimination of the PKI was important because each Moscow and Beijing wanted the support of the PKI because it was the next biggest party outside the Sino-Soviet bloc. And in their squabbles, in their mutual squabbles, Moscow and Beijing, they wanted the support of the PKI. So when the PKI was eliminated, physically eliminated, they started fighting each other. And the U.S. ambassador, Marshall, Marshall Green, he actually wrote down in an interview 20 years later, that what happened in 1965-66 Indonesia was led directly to this split of Moscow and Beijing. So that's how important it was. And the reason it was important is that so many were killed. And the more people killed, the bigger the split was, the bigger the disagreement was. And when I found out, some American sociologist told me that she went along to Central Java, where a lot of the killing occurred in 65-66. She went along there a few years later doing her research and found out that when this killing was occurring in the PKI stronghold, there was American man and woman, two U.S. personnel were involved in instructing the Indonesian army people on how to get the best results in eliminating the PKI. They were apparently flown in by helicopter, and the helicopter was seen there too, she said. The helicopter was involved, and they used to get out of the helicopter, go up to the office, and at the end of the day, go back to the helicopter, and then they fly back to a ship offshore that was from the 7th Fleet. Was they had a ship there, and they probably spent the night on the ship. Then they came out again the next day in the helicopter. It was 23 minutes in a helicopter. So there was direct involvement by, I'm not sure who these people were, but the U.S. personnel, they said, a man and a woman. And I'm sure that's on record somewhere in U.S. records somewhere. So it's up to some American researchers to track that down, I think. But that's the first time direct involvement in this 1965-66 massacre has been brought to light. I was quite surprised when the American sociologist told me that, you know, because it's all been denied up to that point. I mean, Marshall Green used to deny it vehemently that he didn't even know who. He said he didn't even know who Suharto was before that. You know? Indonesian general seemed to rise out of the ranks suddenly and take control and then become president and kick out Sukarno. But in this interview that Marshall Green did, you know, in the 30 years later, when he's basically on his last legs and about to die, he was saying that he used to meet secretly with Suharto. He knew. He was following him, giving him instructions and getting information from Suharto and meeting secretly, not with him, but with Adam Malik, who became the vice president under Suharto. Adam Malik was the go-between. So Marshall Green would meet secretly with Malik. Malik would then pass the information on to General Suharto and vice versa. That's how they communicated for about till the end of 66. So they weren't seen in public together, that is, Marshall Green and Suharto were not seen talking to each other in public. Yeah. But in the interview again, Marshall Green said when they were at the same meeting and they saw each other sort of across the room, they'd wink at each other. They'd wink, you know, to acknowledge each other's presence without actually being seen together. Because if they'd been seen together, Chinese or Russian intelligence would have seen them and perhaps suspected something, you know. They wouldn't, at the time, the claim that the U.S. didn't even know Suharto carried a lot of weight, as though this regime change had just sort of happened in Indonesia. But the involvement of Western intelligence seems to have been quite prominent. When you start digging, it was there. Yeah.
Well, the majority of the American public would not even be aware of a great deal of the cloak and dagger activity that would take place regarding regime change, the overthrow of foreign governments, et cetera, until we got into the many commissions of the 1970s, which did publicly expose a great deal of it, whether it's Rockefeller, Pike, you know, the Church Committee, et cetera, even the HSCA itself. Showing us the sort of malfeasance of these, you know, the CIA was imagined initially as a clearinghouse, as a singular place where all the intelligence community could come together and deposit their information. Today, we live in an atmosphere where we have more than 16 intelligence agencies. None of them seem to be all that centralized. And also, you know, an agency that's not supposed to conduct itself domestically, but does. Versus another one that's only supposed to conduct itself domestically and doesn't. It does lots of foreign work. a lot of things seemingly mislabeled in American intelligence. But before we're all done, Bob Wilson had a question regarding, you know, the fascinating character Schlesinger, and I wanted him to get to it because we're down to the last few minutes here. And again, one more time, just to remind people, we're talking to Greg Polgrain, who is the author of JFK vs. Alan Dulles, Battleground Indonesia. And we have only scratched the surface here in this interview. I want to thank Bob for doing this with me, but I don't even think I could have gotten to as much as I have without Bob's help today. But Bob, you had one more question, so please get to it, and we'll kind of close it out. And I'll just advise people they need to buy the book. They need to read it for themselves, and they need to follow through on the information. Indeed, and don't take this the wrong way, Greg, I think even more work can be done on this. I'm sure
I agree.
Some more documentary evidence could be added to your book. Not saying that you didn't do a great job, but that somebody could take this and go into new directions because there is indeed fresh information in here. So, and that's something I don't say very often at all. Bob, that question about Schlesinger, though.
Yeah, I was just moved. You know, the toll on human suffering here is immense. It seems even worse than Vietnam. And, you know, it just makes you wonder what might have been had 11, 22, 63 men stopped. But Arthur Schlesinger had said the Kennedys are at war with the intelligence community. That's like a paraphrase. But in the midst of like 1.5 million people, you know, dying in Indonesia because of policies and such, it blows your mind. I was just wondering what you thought about Mr. Schlesinger's statement and how you think that these problems that existed then perhaps are still affecting us today.
Yeah, well, would that have been made in the wake of the Bay of Pigs, a statement like that? Because that was when Kennedy was saying he's going to splinter it into a thousand pieces, isn't it? He was definitely at war with the intelligence, and as my description before of Kennedy and Sukarno standing and looking at the ceiling, trying to pick out where the listening devices were, and moving into the bedroom to get away from them. I mean, he was definitely at war. They were undermining his policies. Although, Kennedy's appointment of his replacement of Alan Dulles as head of CIA, his replacement, was such a strange choice. Huh? He was an extremely wealthy businessman who didn't always do what, still did not always do what Kennedy would have wanted him to do, I think. So, yeah, he was even at war, even then with the replacement that he got for Alan Dulles. So it's just a restating the fact that he was in a desperate position. Kennedy's position was in relation to Indonesia it really boggles the mind now how much he depended on his closer friends on the ambassador Jones, for example, and it was through Ambassador Jones that trip in 1963. Proposed trip to Jakarta was arranged. It wasn't just done on the spur of the moment. It took months and months of planning and negotiation, and it was finally announced on, I think, 2 days before Dallas. And people say, oh, well, it the assassination couldn't have been linked to that because it was only 2 days, but actually it had been going for months. The negotiations had been going on for months. And Kennedy was desperate to get US aid again flowing into Indonesia so that he would stand a chance to be re-elected. Otherwise he'd be, well, dead in the water. So Indonesia is such a big country and such wealth was involved. I'm saying there must be a very big part in the motive for assassinating President Kennedy.
Yeah, well, and one would say, Bob points to the million and a half. Well, Indonesians, sure, but, I always contend that the body counts are not necessarily correct either. There's more than one historian that will count a much higher dead in Vietnam than, say, the official numbers give us. And I don't mean the servicemen who were lost, our people, but the idea is that, you see a number of a million and a half Vietnamese, and that's a war, but there are some that contend that that's more like 3 or 4 million is really the number. And I don't argue with them because I feel as though body counts have never been accurate. They're meant to fit a narrative, and then historians sort them out many, many years later when all that were concerned are truly dead and gone. And Indonesia may indeed be like that as well. Yeah,
they were illegal. They were not illegal. They were, part of the community, basically, these peasant rice farmers. They were just rounded up and massacred. They didn't put up any fight. Right. They weren't armed. They were accused of being involved in the killing of six generals on the night of 30th of September 1965. These six generals were massacred, basically. But when I traced back, as you can read in Chapter 7, I traced back and I find that Suharto's involvement in the killing of these six generals is glaring. It is really glaring evidence that Suharto set it up, had the generals killed. Actually, it was his chief intelligence man, Ali Motopo, who was involved in the killing, more than anybody else. Suharto himself wasn't. He went to sleep and got woken up saying, really, has that happened? My goodness. And these six generals were killed, and Suharto then accused the PKI of being behind the killing. When you read it, you can see that it was arranged killing to blame the PKI to then start a mass killing, which went on for the next year. Well, went on for several years, but most of it occurred in 65, 66. Mm-hmm. And that's what shocked Indonesians so much. He ruled by fear for the next 30 years. And when finally deposed in 1998, CIA figures, I think, was 30 billion US, that is. Yeah, that's what they could count anyway. I'm not sure whether that's how accurate it is, but it's minimal rather than max. Marcos, you remember, in Philippines, had 5 billion. Yeah, right. Suharto, 30 billion stashed away. It's amazing what he got away with.
Right.
And that he was the president of Indonesia for so long. And he got into that position through sheer violence.
Well, and one thing is that if one reads what I euphemistically refer to as the assassination guide, which was created by the Central Intelligence Agency more than a decade earlier, and you read through it carefully, you'll take very good note about how a lot of these historical events unfold and how they fit perfectly with the many strategies and suggestions in the document that I love so much, because it says never commit anything to paper, and meanwhile you're reading the paper document that they saved. Anyway, the book again, JFK vs. Allen Dulles, Battleground Indonesia, the author Greg Colgrain. It's an incredibly information-packed read, gives you information and insight which are not available in many other books, I assure you. And I want to thank Bob Wilson for being with us and Professor Colgrain. The Ocelli Effect is done for tonight, but you know how it is. I am Emilio Ocelli. All of you are indeed the effect. Good night.
interested in the truth about the JFK assassination?
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, she knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real Eckerd on the JFK assassination look into her claim?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
Revelation through conversation.